Chapter 15 Fresh Meat. I avoid the office on Saturday. Instead, I spend the morning trying to catch up on the housework. I manage to put in 2 hours before I give up in despair. At least I vacuumed the carpets, and the dishes are all clean. Then I goof off for an hour of not entirely fruitful internet research on a subject that is close to my heart. Ways and means of destroying human bones. But my heart isn't in it, and I keep checking the clock. Finally, I go upstairs and prepare a suitable outfit, something artfully bohemian casual and utterly not office appropriate, and go back downstairs to pretend I'm not waiting. At 2:10, the doorbell chimes. I check the peephole, then open it. Hello? I ask. A gawky teenager with skin to die for and inexpertly applied eyeliner looks up at me. Are you Mo? She asks, sizing me up with a judgmental eye. Yes. I glance past her and see a Volvo estate sitting double parked like a self-propelled roadblock, engine idling. There's a familiar profile at the wheel, and as I glance back at the girl, I recognize echoes of Jim's bone structure. You must be Sally?
That's right, she says. Dad says he can't find anywhere to park. You coming?
1 minute, I promise, and retreat back inside to grab my shoulder bag. Then I vacillate violently for a minute over what to do about my violin case. It's still upstairs in the wardrobe. I ought to take it. I'm responsible for the instrument. But I'm still several steps beyond pissed off at Lecter. I'm furious and not entirely rational. And anyway, from a safety perspective, this is a secured safe house, with an alarm system and wards up to the eaves. Lecter is locked in an anonymous-looking wardrobe, behind a particularly vicious containment ward. And anyone who breaks in and takes him while I'm gone will regret it for about as long as a cable thief gets to regret grabbing hold of a live high-tension beater in an electricity substation. Lecter can look after himself for a few hours, and I really don't want to touch him right now. What is usually a comforting security reflex currently sets my skin acrawl. I feel naked without him. But feeling naked in public is less uncomfortable than having to pick up his case and haul him around with me. I was well on my way to learning how to look after myself before they offered me the custody of a really special instrument. I can still look after myself. All I need is to find a new and suitably qualified custodian, and I can be done with the white violin for good. I suddenly realize that I have turned a hitherto unseen corner in my own mind. I lock up, set the alarm, and follow Sally out to the car. After a brief, "No, you go first," tap dance, she slips into the back, leaving me the front passenger seat.
"Afternoon," Jim says breezily. "Mo, this is Sally. Sally, this is Mo. Please don't kill each other. Have we got everything?"
"I've got my Nexus," Sally says, with the long-suffering air of a teenager who is used to adults trying to organise her. "And my phone, and my pen, and my class notes," she adds.
Oh dear, do I detect an attitude?
"Forget the notes," I advise her. "I don't know what he's been telling you, but we're going to see a farce. Slapstick comedy with music, 18th century style. It has a chunk of romance that was so smutty they had to censor it back in the day. And a sprinkling of pointed political satire that also nearly got it banned. And the music's by Mozart, which might not be your thing, but which is generally considered to be not half bad. Which is why they're still performing it more than 200 years later. My advice is to sit back and enjoy the music, and the costumes, and the farce, or whatever takes your fancy. And ignore the notes. Unless you get hopelessly lost."
"So it's a musical," she says, chin on fist, elbow propped on knee, telegraphing boredom. The last musical Mum took me to was Chicago.
Do you think they'll still be performing Chicago in the 23rd century? I ask lightly. Jim drives the urban tank sedately, but I'm pretty sure I feel his wince through the steering rack when Sally drops her Broadway bombshell. Or maybe I'm projecting. I glance at him. He's in weekend casual. Chinos and open-necked shirt with a sports jacket. This is an afternoon matinee performance. When he's not in uniform or a business suit, he looks younger and freer than the Jim I know from the office. Also older and more mature in a family guy with teenage daughter in tow kind of way. Liz and I have, shall we say, different tastes in music, he says.
Yeah, he likes all kinds of crap 80s rock like Devo and The Fall, Sally warns me.
Are we not human? He asks rhetorically.
No, we are Devo, I answer.
Devo was fun. Musically unpolished and simple, but conceptually ironic fun.
You see,
Jim says to his daughter.
No fair.
There ensues the usual parking in central London ritual. A walk to the Coliseum. Soft drinks and strictly no popcorn for Sally. And then a cracking performance of Mozart's adaptation of Beaumarchais's stage masterpiece. Sally seems bored at first. Or at least expects to be bored until midway through the first act between the dueling insults and the start of the cross-dressing comedy of mistaken identities. By the end of the first act, she's paying attention. And by the end of the second, she's agog. After nearly 3 hours, Sally is clearly flagging. But from what I can see out of the corner of my eye, when she looks at her tablet, she's checking up on the plot rather than goofing off on Facebook. A good sign. Jim is clearly enjoying himself, which is also good. As for me, I'm immersed in Mozart's complexity and richness with a lush visual extravaganza to keep my eyeballs occupied as I follow the music. A pall of existential fatigue actually seems to fall away from me during the performance by the Count's final plea for forgiveness. I'm as relaxed as I've been in weeks. Afterwards, we take a wander and end up in Wagamama, which is clattery and white and stark. A complete antithesis to the opera.
Did you enjoy that?
Jim asks Sally, as she tackles a bowl of yaki udon. She nods, wide-eyed.
It was different, she says. Not stuffy, like I'd imagined.
We could do it again some other weekend, I say. Some operas are stuffy and boring. Bob would say up their own arse. But I know which to avoid. Sally fixes me with a look that stacks at least 3 years on top of her notional age and asks,
What's in it for you?
Jim looks at her sharply, but I shake my head and smile at her. I need to get out more. Your dad can tell you about what I do, but I've been working too hard lately, putting in regular 70-hour weeks. This is me attempting to redress the balance.
Are you married? I mean, do you have a partner? What do they think?
I don't know what he thinks, I say truthfully. We're going through a bad patch, and he's moved out. Like I said, too much work. For both of us, I think.
Ha!
She lowers her eyes back to her soup bowl, worst suspicions evidently confirmed. I'm not dating your father, I tell her. We just agreed we both needed to get out of the office some more. When we finish our food, it becomes apparent that Sally has plans for the evening.
Thanks for the show, it was great. I want to go shopping now, she says. The shops don't shut for another hour.
But your mother's...
Jim is obviously thinking of feeding the parking meter.
I can get the tube home,
she says artlessly.
You two need to talk.
Wait,
he begins to say, but she's already walking away. That one sees more than she lets on. I warn him as his eyes follow her retreating back.
Don't worry, she's got a phone.
I know, he says, sounding anything but confident.
I mean, I know in theory, but it still feels like she only learned to walk last month.
What were you telling me the other night about not helicoptering?
His shoulders slowly relax.
Maybe you're right.
Want to lift home?
I'm afraid I'd rather stay out of pubs or wine bars, it being Saturday night.
A lift would be good.
I shudder slightly at a passing shadow, reach for a hard case that isn't slung over the back of my chair, then check myself. I'm quite tired, to tell the truth. I slept really badly last night.
We head back to the urban tank and climb in.
By the way, he says, there's a run of La Traviata at the Royal Opera House ending next week. Can I interest you in it? Just the two of us, perhaps?
Suspicion and scepticism set up a train wreck clangor in my head. Has he been cold-bloodedly stalking me, using his daughter as a human shield? Or am I seeing ulterior motives where none exist?
Why not take Sally?
She's got exams the week after next. Resits, I'm afraid. Culture's all very well, but not at the expense of grades.
Both his hands are on the steering wheel as he checks for cross-traffic. I can only see his face and side profile, but he seems more intent on driving safely than on slyly checking me out. As excuses go, it has the ring of truth to it.
Okay, then. Yes.
Tentatively, I warn myself.
You may indeed consider me interested. How about, Saturday, if we can score tickets?
You'll be lucky. Would you like me to try and shake some loose?
That'd be great, I tell him.
Saturday evenings hit me hardest when Bob's away exercising sacrifice pits in Yucatan or something. Tonight, I'll be okay. Even if I'm stuck at the kitchen table with a mug of Horlicks and a stack of purchase orders to approve. But often, those evenings seem to stretch out endlessly.
Deal,
he says, looking pleased. His expression makes me feel happy. Jim takes me home, and I resume my macabre research with a light heart and a mug of the aforementioned Horlicks. My social appetite is sated for the time being, and I'm happy to be back in my comfort zone with the front door locked. To tell the truth, I just about managed to forget about Lecter while we were at the opera, but I felt a nagging sense of unease as we braved the crowds on New Oxford Street on our way to the restaurant. And it didn't go away, even when I reminded myself that I was on a date with Officer Friendly and his daughter, that the bracelet on my left wrist was a beefed-up ward strong enough to stop the mandate dead in his tracks, should I run into him again by accident, and that even without the violin, I am a certificated combat practitioner with the ability to cause an unholy amount of collateral damage if I cut loose by accident. I've become accustomed to relying on my singular instrument to an unhealthy degree. I've got to stop using Lecter as a crutch, if only because I can't start to sort things out with Bob if I don't. I take a break from the purchase orders to go back to my macabre and ultimately futile research project. Destroying the bone violin would be quite easy if he was merely made of mundane scrimshaw. Bone is a somewhat more rigid material than the spruce and maple of a conventional instrument, but Lecter's body is thinner in places, to impart the flexibility required by a resonant instrument. If he was inanimate, a wood axe would suffice to dismember him, and a kitchen waste disposal unit would crunch the debris. You might wreck the kitchen unit, but the violin would come off worse. The trouble with trying to do away with them using mechanical tools, the problem that renders this entire project an exercise in futile wish-fulfillment fantasy, if I'm perfectly honest, is that Lecter is an occult instrument. To destroy him, I would first have to reverse and unwind the bindings that anchor his soul, or what passes for one to his body. They weren't designed to be unwound. And to make matters worse, I could reasonably expect Lecter to put up a fight. Your sidekick, Mr. Grenade, stops being your friend the moment you pull his pin out. Just so with the violins Eric Zahn created at the behest of Dr. Mabuza. Lecter has steadily grown more powerful ever since we entered the opening stages of Case Nightmare Green. He's now alarmingly strong. If I'd met him for the first time, as he is now, he'd have eaten me alive. I expect any attempt at exorcism will result in him making an all-out bid to suck my soul out through my eyeballs. And I suspect the only entity I've met who could possibly hold him in check is the Eater of Souls. Lecter is bound by Gesh to serve the laundry, and my superiors have entrusted him to me because they think I'm a safe pair of hands. I'm responsible unless and until I can find a new bearer to hand him over to. And I can't in all good conscience condemn someone else to what he'll inevitably do to their mind. So, I'm stuck with him, unless I can find a legitimate reason to destroy him. But one does not go cap in hand to the board of directors to request the destruction of an irreplaceable offensive artifact just because of a spot of relationship trouble. Short of obtaining clear evidence that Lecter has become a danger to the organisation, getting the SA to agree to sign off on a formal request for his destruction, and running it up the chain to the board, I don't see any permanent way out of my present fix. On the other hand, a nice relaxing swim in the channel doesn't have to be permanent. Thinking these thoughts, I walk upstairs, unseal the ward on the wardrobe, remove the violin case, and carry it back down to the kitchen table. Then I open the lid and stare at the thing inside. "Do you know what I'm thinking?" I ask. The violin lies still, quiescent and inert in its coffin lined with ivory silk. "I went to the opera today," I tell him. "I went outside without you. For the second time this week." It's true. The meeting at ACPO and my afternoon with Jim and Sally are the only times this year that I've allowed myself to get more than 100 meters away from him. I'm still mad at you. But now I know something else. I can live without you. Modulo some withdrawal symptoms, but what do you think of that? I'm not sure that I can live without my instrument, but I'm not prepared to live with him if we can't establish exactly who's in charge of our relationship. What do you say?
Sorry.
I've been thinking, I muse aloud. Destroying you, unbinding you would be difficult. Not to mention extremely hard to obtain authorization for. I can send you to sleep with the fishes for a while, but that wouldn't stop you finding a new host, would it? Maybe the best thing would be if I just admit defeat and surrender you. I can tell Dr. Armstrong I can't carry you any longer. I can tell him why. And I can tell him, warn him, that you're growing stronger. They'll need a more powerful player to control you. And those don't come along very often, do they? So, they'll carry you back to that humidity-controlled safe in the basement of Danzy House and seal you up alone in the dark again. And this time, it'll be for months or years, maybe decades. All alone in the dark.
Please don't do that.
So it's please now, is it? I shout, thumping the kitchen table so that the violin case bounces. Well, tough. I take a deep breath. Here's what's going to happen. I am going to get a warded gun locker installed here and another at the office. You're going to live in them when I don't need you. At night, for example, when I'm sleeping. You'll come out of your box when I need to practice and when I need to deploy you and for transport. That's all. If you try to escape or slither into my dreams, that's it. It's the safe for you.
I'm through with this. You've had your chance. You tried to kill Mary. You tried to kill Bob. You tried to force me to play you. No more. No more chances. No more apologies. That stuff is over for good. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good. I close the violin case. Back in your box. I carry him back upstairs and stash him in the wardrobe again.
So hungry.
I hear him whisper in my head as I close the door and then turn the key in the lock. His voice is like contaminated engine oil floating on the surface of a river at night. A sharp stab of anxiety grips me. Is he lying to me? Something about his supine display of remorse rings false. Well, fuck you, I think. Sleep tight.
Need food.
I activate the ward. Blissful silence descends. The rest of the weekend is uneventful. If only I could relax and enjoy it. It's Tuesday, and pigeons released weeks ago are coming home to roost. Monday started with an all-hands meeting to introduce our four new hires to the analysts, HR, and support folks. That kind of event is always risky. Teetering on the edge of embarrassment. For quiet, gawky Billy, aka the Torch, it's his first ever job in a workplace with carpet, much less indoor plumbing and co-workers who wear suits. There's a 150% pay rise hanging over him like the sword of Damocles. What is he supposed to do to earn it? He's silently terrified, even though he has enough firepower in his right index finger to take out a main battle tank. For my part, I'm just glad that his hoodie, combats and trainers are clean enough he doesn't look as if he's walked in off a construction site. B, aka Lucy Taylor, is infinitely more mature. If by mature you mean sassy. With her dark hair gathered in pigtails, and wearing a 50s-style yellow dress with black horizontal stripes, she could pass for a hipster on speed. If hipsters had a permanent caffeine buzz and metaphorical stingers. She's excited. Energised, eager to make a difference. This poise has Billy unsurprisingly caught somewhere between fascination and terror. So he's pointedly ignoring her. Great way to start building a team. Our two other new hires aren't here yet. But I can at least show everyone their mugshots and order that they be made welcome on arrival. Speaking of which, I'd like you all to welcome Billy and Lucy to the Transhuman Police Coordination Force. They've got a steep learning curve ahead of them, and lots of training courses before they can represent the force in public, along with our two other frontline superpowers, Lollipop Bill and Captain Marvelous, who will be arriving next week. Billy and Lucy. Mary Murphy will start you on your basic orientation today and introduce you to everyone this afternoon, so you don't need to memorise their names right now. I know this is all a lot to take in at once. I suddenly realise that even though Jim's elsewhere and Sam is visiting a sick relative, there are nearly a dozen people present. But don't worry, you'll get used to it in no time. The formal introduction's done. I beat a hasty retreat into my office. There's plaster dust on the carpet and an unpleasant oily smell in the air, courtesy of the hulking gun safe in the corner. Footnote. It arrived early last week. When I phoned Harry the horse at the new annex and he said it couldn't be fitted before next month, I snarled semi-politely and referred him to the senior auditor. It's amazing what taking God's name in vain can accomplish when you've got God on speed dial and he considers your needs to be an urgent priority. I check my chair carefully for plaster dust before I sit down. I'm wearing my smart suit today, in anticipation of spending the afternoon at a home office briefing session, and I'm about to bury myself in prep for the anticipated grilling on anything we can contribute to the Freudstein problem, when Ramona motors in. "Hi, Mo," she says.
I've got a surprise for you.
What kind? I ask cautiously.
Nothing bad.
She smiles gleefully as she whirs forward, holding up a USB key.
What's that? First cut at a promo video. Want to watch it together?
I suppress my first reflexive response, a groan, force a smile, and say, can do. Then I shove the memory stick into the front of my newly chained to the desk PC. We've recently acquired new software that locks everything down. Only lets data in, not out. When you plug in a dongle, and refuses to run software that hasn't been installed and authorised centrally by IT support. In my opinion, and everyone else's, it turns our PCs into single-function boat anchors. But 2 months and 10 employees on, our organisational threat surface has expanded until it's too dangerous for us to risk laptops. Also, we now have to play by civil service regs, not laundry rules. Let's see what they've come up with. Move over. I shove my chair sideways to make room for Ramona. There is indeed a movie file on the stick. I double-click, wait for the obligatory 3 virus scanners to do their stuff, then sit back while the video player fills the screen with the first thing the organisational PR agency's collective subconscious have come up with. Start. Animation showreel. The scene. A boringly normal-looking suburban street in any town, England. Dogs bark. Children shout. A delivery van drives slowly past. Cut to. A different street. More densely urban. Houses on one side, a big new charter school campus on the other. Uniformed kids hang around outside the gates and in the playground. Voice over. Keeping our schools and homes safe. Pan right. A street corner adjacent to the school. Just round the corner, past more buildings, the camera zooms in to frame a man in a lime green pervert suit and cloak, crouching in front of a house. He brandishes a teddy bear at the camera. Pervert suit. Or, I am nonce boy. I hang out on street corners near schools and hypnotise your kids. Who knows what hideous perversions I fantasise about perpetrating on their smooth underage flesh, what nightmarish pedo-bear-related fantasies I intend to corrupt their innocent little souls with. Zoom out. A posse of superheroes are racing down the side street towards Pervert Suit. Superhero 1. It's Nonce Boy! Get him! Superhero 2. On my way! Superhero 3, female. Flying scissor kick, Operogi jump. They fight. Cut to Nonce Boy lying prone on the pavement with his hands and feet hogtied in elaborate Japanese rope bondage style. The superheroes stand over him. He grins horribly at the camera. Nonce Boy, they're making a big mistake. Cut to a police interview room. Two inspectors are cross-examining Nonce Boy. Inspector 1.
And what exactly did Superhero 1 say?
Nonce Boy.
I heard him distinctly say, it's Nonce Boy, get him! Then he attacked me without provocation.
Inspector 2.
Are you denying your previous? You've done time for hideous crimes of hideousness. He obviously thought you were about to get up to your old tricks again.
Nonce Boy.
Nevertheless, I has my human rights, including the right not to be beaten up by random vigilantes,
confidingly.
And there's more.
Inspector 1.
What else?
Nonce Boy.
Superhero 3 used her operogi jump on me. That's sexual assault, that is.
Cut 2. A police briefing room with the two inspectors. Inspector 2.
It's no good. He's got us banged to rights.
Inspector 1.
We can't let him go. He's a pervert.
Inspector 2.
But he's right about one thing. The superheroes who took him down are vigilantes. They didn't observe due process. They didn't identify a suspect in the process of committing or preparing a crime. They aren't sworn officers of the law, like you and me. They use dubious or outright illegal methods, and they inadvertently handed his defence a watertight case. In fact, they'll be lucky if he doesn't sue them.
Inspector One.
All we can do is let him go and hope he falls downstairs on his way out of the cell block.
Inspector Two.
And this is a one-story high police station, so that's not terribly likely.
Inspector One addresses the camera.
So, Non's boy walks free, all because those superheroes acted like idiots.
Zoom in. Inspector One.
Inspector One. Want to be a superhero? Don't be like these numpties. Join up with TPCF. Get wise. Get trained. Get your villain.
Feed to Home Office logo. Transhuman Policy Coordination Force contact information.
Well, what do you think?
I think that was pretty good, actually. It compared favourably with Plan 9 from Outer Space. 3 Rotten Tomatoes?
I was thinking surf Nazis must die.
Actually, if they ham it up a bit more, see if they turn the dial from 9 to 11... and switch from animation to human actors, might hit Adam West Batman values of kitsch. Who knows? We might be on course to be the first government agency to win a Golden Oyster Award.
But it got the key points across, didn't it?
I know it's meant to be funny, but there's a fine line between being laughed with and being laughed at. If we go public with this, we'll be a laughingstock.
So, that's a no, Mo.
Remember the search for the homesick sense of humour? They had to ground the rescue choppers for maintenance checks. They'd been airborne so long. If we take this to the Home Office, someone's going to have to explain all the jokes to her, and I don't want that someone to be me. I'm pretty sure she's got Medusa DNA.
Pause.
Unless we make it look like a leak. What if we let it show up on YouTube with a disclaimer saying it's an unreleased rough treatment?
You mean it's kitsch enough it might just go viral?
But we could disclaim it if it backfires.
Holy Batman, that's brilliant, Mo.
Who knows? It's a long shot. But it just might work.